You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Before I introduce this panel, I just wanted to give you all a couple of news headlines which just came across from my publication, AlaskaDispatch.com, and that reminds me, I wanted you all to know that one of the things that we are doing as part of launching the Arctic Circle organization is increasing the amount of Arctic news that we carry in the Dispatch. It's going to have its own name and URL, ArcticWire.com. So I'm just going to read you three headlines that are there as of an hour ago. The first one reads as follows. Moving on, comma, Shell signs agreement with Russia to seek oil in Arctic. This would be a partnership between Shell and Gazprom. Okay? I would venture to say we could have seen that one coming. Next one. Quote, jazzed by methane hydrate's potential, state, in this case the state of Alaska, Commissioner Dan Sullivan, state agrees to cooperate with feds, meaning the Department of Energy in this case. They're going to have a memorandum of understanding to pursue technical advances in methane hydrate technology. Okay? Extremely newsworthy. And the last one is this. Quote, with melting, will the melting Arctic open up LNG shipping lanes to be traversed by ice-breaking LNG tankers. Okay. That gives us the backdrop for the news. Without further ado, I have sitting here three of the most distinguished people I know on any number of scores. I'm not going to go through their CVs for you because they're very long and distinguished, all of them. But what I'd like to do is simply have them say a word or two about their background when they start to answer the question. And I have intentionally given them a very, very broad question because my thought is that they have each had differing experiences in the issues of Arctic development, and rather than pigeonhole with a narrow question, I'd rather they each tailor the answers to their own involvement. So my question is essentially this. Based on your own experiences to date with development in your region in Alaska, which parenthetically is all along the North Slope of Alaska, how do you think that the experiences of the past now will affect your reactions to any kinds of development discussions going forward? And I'll start with you, Edward.
Good afternoon. I give you all a big smile today, even though this is such a serious subject. Thank you, Alice. I want to just start off by thanking my Creator, who gives us all things, the resources we depend on for our lives, as well as the resources economically to survive in our land. My name is Edward Sagan Itta. I'm an Inupiaq Eskimo, born and raised in Barrow, Alaska. I was just there yesterday. No, day before yesterday. Takes a while to get here. But it's thank you for the warm weather, by the way. So really appreciate that. I'm past mayor of the North Slope Borough, our municipal government, which encompasses 88,000 square miles of the very northern part of Alaska. I'm also a member of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and the past vice chair of our Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, which works with the International Whaling Commission on sustaining our whaling activities, and also, very importantly, the husband of my wife, Elsie May, over here. I think that's an appropriate title, because she has been responsible for a large part of what I've done. I didn't hear you real well. Did you want me to go ahead and lead off with the first question, Alice?
I would like that, if you don't mind, but tailored to your own personal experience.
Okay. And I'm going to be looking at the clock here, because I know we're going to be pressed for time.
5 minutes.
Okay. And if I run a minute or two over, I'm going to give my 3 minutes to Daly on her on the UN question, because I think appropriately that's your area. And it's a pleasure. Thank you, Alice. Thank you, Charlie, for inviting us here. Good to see our friend President Grissom again, and Kupak Koyanakpak for your both of you leading us off this morning. And it's my pleasure to be back with my friends Nuyare and Daly over here. And I just feel comfortable up here with them, with me today. Every time I listen to experts or read expert analysis of on climate change, it seems that from week to week, the change is accelerating. And we are living that up here, up where I live. So with all these very varied issues, we as Inupiaq Eskimos are kind of being dragged in on what I would call the slipstream of events that are going now and very much directly impact us as a people. So my initial answer is that we Inupiaqs need to be ourselves as we have been for thousands of years. And think about our lives. My father, may he rest in peace since 5 years from now, was born and raised in an area to the west of us called Cape Halkett. He eventually moved to Barrow, where I was born and raised. He was raised in the nomadic way, just starting from 1919 till he passed away 5 years ago. So the amount of change since then to where we are today has been dramatic, to say the very least. And what's amazing today is that I now have ready access to information from events all over the world, right at my own home, with my fingertips. It is truly amazing. Traditionally, information was carried from camp to camp, village to village, community to community, by oral means. And that information was vital. It included what I would call Eskimo statistics of when and where animals were, where the hunting was good, where the fishing was available, moving, who was hunting, the success or the failure of that area, of which their lives, our lives, depended on. And if you think about it, really, it was just a different version of our unemployment rate, our housing starts, how our stock market was doing, because that's what it was for us. And with so much going on, my general view again also is that we as a people must avoid hitting the panic button. There is so much to deal with. My whaling crew is getting ready today. I was getting a text here about cleaning our ice cellars where we store our food, where permafrost is affecting us so much. He said, should we bother? I said, yes, you will bother. We need a place to store our whale if we should get the gift of the whale. So we've been adapting to change, and my crew will be living together on the edges of the ice, hunting the bowhead whale, starting next week, if not this weekend. And we have been doing this for hundreds of years. And our history as a people is strong in the sense that we have always come together collectively to deal with very big issues that affect us as a whole. And this next challenge to us, related to your question, Alice, is resource development. And we need, in my opinion, to elevate the discussion so that what I just said about our subsistence way of life has the same value as the resource development value is going to happen. We very often feel we're way down here, if not even on the radar sometimes, as all this activity is happening. And that's why I'm so thankful I'm here today as we discuss issues that are going to affect our daily lives that are made here at the center of power in the United States of America on the federal government. So David was right that it's very hard to get our comments and concerns addressed to the appropriate 27 agencies that deal with both land and sea and the various issues that are coming up with us up here. The value that we assign to subsistence is given equal status to the monetary value associated with oil, mining, shipping. And that is our way of life. That sometimes, and the people don't understand what it is we're talking about, and my friend Jimmy is going to talk about it a little more, is our subsistence way of life that has gone on for thousands of years. I would say, just as I am expected to use a bank to pay my mortgage, developers and hopeful developers must also expect to understand and act upon that value of subsistence. Then I think we can truly have a discussion about developing strategies for the Arctic. My sense sometimes, and I don't like to be overly broad, but generally the investment sector and the government at large, look at us, Alaska Natives, the first Americans, the first Alaskans, as something of a curiosity. They watch us, they look at us, and they observe. What do they think? And by the same token, we also watch and look and listen and say, do they even know what we are talking about? So I hope to spend some time in the near future here helping investors to get to know the communities, because certainly as mayor, working with Shell, the announcement that was just made, I spent 6 years, three-fourths of my time dedicated to just offshore events and dealing with all the agencies that we had to deal with. So it was a very big learning experience for me, of which I'm so fortunate to have participated in, and I'm so thankful. So the path forward, no doubt, going to be difficult, challenging, but I keep sharing the word with my people that we need to stand up. We need to voice our opinion and engage in the crossroads of investment, resource development, and the development of policy, such as we are doing here. So, in the interest of time, I'll just skip through some of my points I had here. But to note that we as Inupiaqs have always lived in changing times. We have been successful. We have lived through famine. where our aunts and uncles didn't make it because there was not enough resources. So we know our mandate is to take care of our land and the sea. The one picture that I want to leave with you is that we Inupiaqs are the land and the sea. You cannot separate those three. We are one. So that has always been passed on to us as whaling captains, as hunters, providers for the family, that continue for us. There's a third player, and I close with this. There's a relatively new player in the field, and it's been amazing. And we talk about it, climate change. We watched for the first time in my memory the ice break off last month right at the shore of Barrow. Never happened before. And here we are going to go whaling. My wife and I watched a truck pull down, or it was parked already there. They were actually hunting seals from a truck, if you can believe that, from shore. So seals are very basic food for us. So in this larger context, and talk about balance, oil and gas development, no question, has to be done very cautiously. It's still a new frontier. We are dealing, as Inupiaqs, within our own state, with a drill baby drill crowd that want to go ahead and proceed. And on the other hand, with the extreme end of the conservation environmental groups that want to stop everything, and therefore affect our economic well-being. So I talk about balance. How do you do that with us as a people? It has to be done with sensitivity, with the fate of the species all involved, of which we are a part of the species. So I would close with that for now and comment a little bit later. So again, thank you. By the way, Alice is a champion of the Inupiaq Eskimos here, so I thank you for that. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Edward. Jimmy, I'll let you introduce yourself again briefly, but I'm hoping you can give an answer to this question about development based on your present role with the ICC.
Thank you, Alice, and thank the organizers for this meeting. The earlier presentations and discussions and speeches were all very informative, and I thank you for that. Well, I'm Jim Stotts, and I grew up with Edward. We're both from Barrow. We played basketball together for the high school team, and we go back a long ways. And Daly and I worked together on and off for years. We've been around for a while. I'm the head of delegation for the Inuit Circumpolar Council to the Arctic Council. And so I'm involved very much in the Arctic Council. I was actually one of the founders of the Arctic Council some 33 years ago. I would like to say that the first, just a little historical footnote, the first chair of the Arctic Council was an Inuk. Her name was Mary Simon, and she was from Canada. And she's a former chair of the ICC as well. The ICC is an international organization, represents 160,000 Inuit from Chukotka, Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. But my remarks today will be, I will be speaking as an American, as an American Inuk from Alaska. And I have a series of just impressions from my experience over the last 30 years of being involved in this Arctic stuff. I worked for a company called the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation for 30 years. The Arctic Slope Regional Corporation is a land claims company. We actually own an oil field in the northern part of Alaska. It's called the Alpine Oil Field. So we've been involved in oil and gas for some time. We also have a large investment in oil field service activities. So it's not new to us. Just to the south of us in the region that's called the Nana region, our fellow people run the Red Dog mine, one of the largest, I think, lead zinc mine in the world. So these sorts of resource developments are not new for us. We've enjoyed the benefits. It's not all benefits, but we've enjoyed some of the benefits from that development. But I would have to say that, in my opinion, the future development will be more difficult, simply because it's going to be in the ocean. Inuit have always made a distinction between development on land and development in the water. It's not quite as easy, if you make a mistake, to recover from working in the water. And the things that everybody's talking about, the buzzwords, the offshore oil and gas, of course, marine transportation, commercial, tourism on a large scale, and fishing, which is something that people don't talk about too much, but it's starting to be discussed, commercial fishing in the Arctic Ocean. Inuit are a coastal people, and we depend on the ocean for our life and our culture. So what happens in the ocean is we're committed to making sure that it's done properly. In Alaska, and only in Alaska compared to Canada and Greenland anyway, there are two issues that still need to be resolved, in our opinion, two indigenous rights that need to be resolved for Alaska Native peoples. One is the issue of self-determination or self-governance, and the other is hunting and fishing rights, which need to be settled and negotiated with the government. If these are not negotiated and put in place so that we have an understanding of how things will proceed and how these resources, particularly the animal resources, will be developed and managed, much of this discussion about development in our opinion, shouldn't go forward. Quite literally, our culture is at stake, and the Arctic biodiversity is at stake. Generally, I'm more optimistic that development will be done in a balanced way in the United States, because recently the federal government appears to have taken its responsibility and has started to be more active in the development of policy in the Arctic. As was mentioned earlier this morning, there are a number of federal initiatives that have come forth that set the stage, I would say, for developing Arctic policy. I'm glad to see that the United States is stepping up. It's a positive development. I have to say this, and I hope I don't offend anybody, but I'm worried about how development will proceed in Russia. Russia represents approximately 60% of the Arctic land mass, water mass, and I have concerns. As an Inuk, I have concerns about the environment, and I also have concerns about how indigenous people are treated in the Arctic part of Russia. That's my own personal observation. The Arctic Council has benefited the region a very, very big way, in my opinion. It's been productive having discussions with the Arctic neighbors, both the states and the permanent participants. It's getting stronger with each passing year, becoming more assertive, and I think that's a good thing for the region. I think that the Arctic Council is a winner and is an organization that can only grow and become more important. I wonder what benefits will accrue to my people from this development. What are the social and economic and cultural benefits that we will get from this development? There must be tangible improvements to our quality of life. There must be tangible improvements in our communities, in infrastructure, and in other improvements that help our daily living. By the way, opportunities for jobs, in my opinion, is not an idea of a benefit. That's not good enough for us. One last point that I would like to make, it seemed from the tone this morning that everybody's ganging up on poor Uncle Sam. They say the U.S. has not developed policy and regulation that allows development to proceed. It's too slow, ineffective. What's new about that? I don't agree with this characterization up to a point. As I mentioned earlier, there are several initiatives that have been conducted by the government, the federal government, that are setting the ground rules, the framework for developing Arctic policy, and I will use the word comprehensive Arctic policy. Any policy that's developed in the Arctic must be comprehensive. It must be holistic. It must have a social piece. It must have a cultural piece. It must have a definitely an environmental piece. And then there's the business activity. All of these three things must intersect in some perfect way of doing development. If they don't, then the environment, the Arctic environment, for those of us that live up there, we know this. There's very little chance to recover if you've made a big mistake. There's very little chance. It's a very unforgiving place, even with the ice going away. So if these three areas, the social / cultural, the environment, and the economic interests can't intersect somehow and cooperate together, it doesn't make sense, as far as I'm concerned, to develop anything up there. As the frontline people living right there on the water, we're the ones that are taking the risk for your activities. We're not prepared to let that happen. The risk must be taken a closer look at. I'm sure some of you out there are aware of some recent calls for caution from the business community, particularly in the area of risk assessment and insuring and paying for a mishap. We in the ICC, together with the government of Greenland, have been pushing the notion of an international spill contingency fund. We're not sure there's enough money out there to clean up an oil spill if there's a big oil spill. We think this is something that needs to be considered, and we will keep promoting that. We have been promoting it. We haven't got much traction. We did try to put it in the Arctic Council Oil Spill Task Force. We didn't make it, but we'll keep trying. Comprehensive. When the government and the environmental community and industry get together and figure out a way forward together, then development will happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Jimmy. Lots there to chew on when we get to come back with questions. Daly, I'd love to ask you if you could just pick up on this same question, although I'm very anxious to get to the question of the UN Declaration, but we'll come to that next.
Okay. Brianna, first of all, I'd like to thank Dr. Ebinger and the Brookings Institution for the invitation to share some thoughts and perspectives with each of you. I am likewise pleased to be in the company of Edward and Jimmy, longtime mentors, I should say. In addition, it's good to be in the company of President Grimson again and Premier Kleist. In response to the question, I think that, first of all, it's absolutely imperative that those of you especially those of you new to embracing Arctic issues and the Arctic as a region, the circumpolar Arctic as a region, know some pivotal points in terms of the history. I'm not going to reach back thousands of years, but I think it is important to at least acknowledge that 2013 is the 40th anniversary of the first Arctic Peoples Conference held in Copenhagen, Denmark, hosted by the International Work Group on Indigenous Affairs. Inuit, Sami gathered, as well as other Indigenous peoples, gathered to discuss issues concerning the Arctic and their views. In addition, I think it's absolutely imperative that in the context of resource development, that we recognize the discovery of oil on the North Slope of Alaska in 1968 as the trigger for the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. So when we look back at the past chapters concerning resource development, I think we have to acknowledge that. There were some highly problematic provisions contained in that piece of legislation. For example, the purported extinguishment of Aboriginal right and title to any lands outside of the Act, in addition to even more significant, I think, the purported extinguishment of Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights. And to this day, neither the state of Alaska nor the federal government, the United States of America, neither of them have adequately addressed this particular issue. And by this, I mean entrenching the rights of Alaska Native people, including the Inupiat, to hunting, fishing, and other harvesting activities, and to entrench that in federal law. So if you think about resource development, and as Edward has indicated, the notion of our stock market and what we depend upon in terms of the future, well, the past survival, the present survival, and the future survival of Arctic indigenous communities, not just in Alaska but circumpolar wide, these issues have to be addressed. In response to the question, I think it's also important to reach back in time. Jimmy's reference to Mary Simon, former Arctic ambassador for Canada, this is absolutely significant in and of itself. But I think it's also important in the context of the question about resource development to reach back even further to Eben Hobson, the founder of the Inuit Circumpolar Council. And I just want to quickly read out a couple of very relevant quotes. One is from a grant request that was submitted by Hobson and other members of the North Slope Borough in order to organize the first Inuit Circumpolar Conference. "We Eskimo are an international community sharing common language, culture, and a common land along the Arctic coast of Siberia, Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. Although not a nation state, as a people, we do constitute a nation." This is in 1976, okay? Further, in the opening remarks that Hobson shared with all of the Inuit gathered in Barrow in June of 1977 for the first organizing meeting of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, though our Russian sisters and brothers were not present at that conference, he stated, "Our language contains the intricate knowledge of the ice that we have seen no others demonstrate. Without our central involvement, there can be no safe and responsible Arctic resource development." He went on to say, "The status of our rights as Inupiat is necessarily the core of any successful protection of our mutual Arctic environment security. It is important that our governments, all of them, agree about the status of these rights if they are to be uniformly respected." Again, this is all the way back to 1977. So I would submit, in the context of resource development issues and the need for not only the United States but every Arctic Rim country to turn their eyes toward the status and the rights of indigenous peoples within the circumpolar region, that these words be recognized, that these words be embraced. And to some extent, through the Arctic Council as an important pathway to ensure direct indigenous involvement. With regard to resource development, I think that more will have to be done, especially within, as President Grimson indicated last night in his comments at dinner, that the Arctic Council is an inspirational model. But here again, I think that more will have to be done to be responsive to at least the desire of individual elder statesmen like Eben Hobson. I think that at this point in time, with regard to resource development, the reference that you made, and I know the specific question concerning the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, that fortunately in this comprehensive international indigenous human rights instrument that provisions have been embraced by the United Nations to affirm the right of indigenous peoples to determine their own priorities for their development. And how that intersects with the development views and agendas of the Arctic Rim nations, as well as other nations that are clawing at the door of the Arctic Council and elsewhere, that such an operative article within this international human rights instrument bears a need for respect and recognition of the fundamental rights of indigenous peoples. And I'll speak to those a bit further in response to your third question.
Thank you, Daly. I guess the way I'd like to phrase the next question then, Edward, we'll start with you, is given everything that has just been said, how do you feel about the structural aspects of indigenous peoples' participation in the Arctic Council and in discussions with the state of Alaska, private developers, and all the forces that propel industrial development and resource development in your region? Do you feel as if you have the legal structural framework to give you the kind of outcomes-based representation you are seeking?
Thank you, Alice. And I'm going to largely leave the Arctic Council and the governance level issues to my friends Jimmy and Daly. And I think the events happening now with the creation of Arctic Circle are what can help immensely for us to deal with the level of sophistication we need now to deal effectively with the very questions that you are asking. We have a long ways to go. But to be frank, I think local leaders, before they can feel comfortable with how private sector determines when and where to invest, and how to organize their decisions, there needs to be more of such as what Arctic Circle is doing and what David brought out this morning on the paper that was presented with the help of our friends from the Arctic Research Commission. In particular, I want to thank Fran Ulmer, who participated actively and championed a part of this report. Daly mentioned the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, and that was really important for Alaskan Natives. We should be proud of the law, and we need to protect the best that ANCSA has. It's not perfect, but it was developed in a rush. It dealt with the land and not the ocean. It left out our hunting and fishing rights. So the North Slope Borough, during my term as government, to answer your question directly, I found it lacking because it's a subsidiary of the state as a municipal government. And the creation, the very creation itself, was fought tooth and nail by our own state of Alaska in an effort to not have the indigenous Inupiaq people participate in resource development. I think that's a very important point, and this was just as of 1971 on the creation. So it provided, I think people assume ANCSA took care of it. It provided the framework for investment purposes and feel that in a sense maybe it would protect indigenous interests. But I don't think that's true. The landscape is now too complex, and as I said, ANCSA was about the land. That's the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act. And by the way, I still thank Spiro Agnew, who was the vice president, who made the Trans-Alaska Pipeline happen, one vote, by our own federal government also. So I think you just need a little bit of history. And again, as I stated, we cannot separate the land and the sea and the ocean from the Inupiaq up there. So we need a new model and a new understanding. A 21st century model, if you will. And I believe that's what the Arctic Circle is trying to do. So we have to break the mold. And I am so grateful that events like this happen in this very prestigious institute with the best minds, the best thinkers, and influential people that are affected. And by the way, on the website as I speak, I say hello to my daughter, who is on the internet now watching and learning about what we are doing here. And in closing, I'd just like to say the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, as a framework, as good as it has been, provided some very rigid barriers, if you will, to the regional corporations that were supposed to follow the Western model of getting into and being active part of America. It was about creating a for-profit model when our traditional economy was subsistence. So I put that in context, and I have to ask this. How many barrels of oil have the ANCSA corporations produced? These are the major corporations that were produced that were to protect the best interest of all indigenous natives in the state of Alaska. I can tell you today, very little, but mostly none. They have not produced a barrel of oil. So really, here's what we have. ANCSA did attempt to bring us into the 21st century with a model as a contractor. ANCSA helped, but ANCSA also was incomplete. Do we really, as a people, as Inupiaqs, have the ability to invest at the ground level, at where it starts? I answer your question with questions because we don't have the answer yet. How will investors approach the new Arctic? I know there are now investors who have become socially conscious, if you will, and have realized that the indigenous people have been left out again. Because we go back a short 200, 250 years ago to the first Americans, and where they have ended up today, our brothers and sisters here in America. What happened? They got left out. But we are fortunate I don't have the answers. And I'm surely not going to assume that national and multinational corporations are going to want to open up and say, hey, we want to share your profits with you. I wish that could happen. But we want to be a part of what is happening to us because we are Americans, as Jimmy stated. We know the energy needs of our country. We want to participate. In my sense is that we all need to reinvigorate our efforts to think globally. We are all together, and we as Inupiaq have understood that for centuries, that we are together. And climate change, as is so topical, seems is changing lives for us. We sense and know it's going to affect Americans. It's going to affect the international community. And I thank President Grissom, our friend, having the vision and being able to articulate what is truly at stake here. And I thank you.
And I thank you. Jimmy, I know it's an enormously broad question, but again, think about your structural participation within the institutions that exist, including with the private sector.
Well, I always say when I grow up, I want to be a green man. I think that's a model that I like. One that makes us
all proud, and I can tell you when you walk on the streets of Nuuk, that's the best place to be as an Inuk, having a freedom and a sense of pride and the right and the opportunity to take care of yourself. I think it's gotten better, our ability to participate, from 30 years ago. The Arctic Council, I really can't complain too much about the Arctic Council. We are allowed to participate freely in the meetings. We do have problems at times with capacity. It's not cheap to fly off to Stockholm and Reykjavik. But we do our best, and I would say that they do listen to us. They don't always agree, but they do listen. Industry. I think industry, you can talk to industry as long as you have something they want, because they want to talk to you. If you don't have something they want, well, they generally kind of leave you alone. But in the North Slope of Alaska, where I'm from, they're around all the time. They talk to us all the time. We have meetings with Shell, and we have meetings with BP, and so on and so forth. So that's a long, evolving relationship that we've had, a love-hate relationship that we've had with the industry. I know in other parts of the state it's similar with both commercial fishing, where a number of Inuit are Inuit millionaires in the fishing business, and also in mining. I would say that our relationship, with all due respect to Mead Treadwell sitting over there in the corner, that's a rocky conversation at times for us, and it primarily comes down to sometimes we are in competition with the state. I will put it that way. We are in competition for resources in some sense, particularly living resources. We are in competition for governance. And that does create some problems from time to time. I will say that recently, I'll just say it. As we know in this country, it depends on who's got the White House. It's a good guy in the White House these days for us, I'll put it that way. He listens, and he actually is enforcing what is is the law of the land, actually, and has been for many, many decades, that Native people should be consulted with on anything that will affect them. And I think that the Obama administration has actually tried to do that. So you will see, or you heard this morning from David Hayes and others, you know, a big part of what they want to do is ensure that the indigenous people's perspectives are listened to and their wants and needs are addressed. So I would say overall, it's been better. It can always be worse. But we are participating. We're not bashful, and we do have some plans of our own, and we will pursue them. So thank you.
Thanks, Jimmy and Daly. I'll ask you the same question, and then if you want to, just roll right into the next question, which is particularly of interest to you and for us to hear from you.
Okay. Well, with regard to direct involvement of indigenous peoples in the Arctic through the permanent participant status that they presently exercise within the context of the Arctic Council, I was one of the very first persons who said that's not good enough. And I was sort of the outlier. Mary Simon had some language concerning the rules of procedure. Have a look at these. I didn't agree with the rules of procedure. I didn't agree with the idea that indigenous peoples within the Arctic ought to be simply permanent participants. Yes, it is very important and useful that decisions are made by consensus. But my experience within the United Nations with consensus is that the lowest common denominator rallies and gains consensus. Now, you know, things I have not had in the way that Jimmy has had direct firsthand experience within the context of discussion and negotiation and deliberations within the Arctic Council. But as an outside observer, I thought that it wasn't good enough in terms of indigenous peoples being at the table, participating as permanent participants, that more had to be done. The other comment relates to something stated by Kupik with regard to the taboo issues, the items that are not on the table within the Arctic Council. And if you think about human rights, and if you understand the nature of human rights, and that they're interrelated, interdependent, indivisible, and interconnected, the same goes with the day-to-day lives of indigenous peoples throughout the entire circumpolar Arctic world, as well as around the globe, that one issue is related to another. Now, how is it that we're going to talk about direct involvement in some issues, like economic development maybe, or environmental protection, or cheer and encourage important legally binding international treaties that emerge out of the Arctic Council, like those of search and rescue, but not talk about militarization, security, and oil and gas development offshore, and some of the things that are not necessarily on the table in terms of the Arctic Council. So I think that the emergence of the Arctic Circle is potentially one pathway and possibly will become a lesson or primer to the eight Arctic Rim nation states. And the real rub that emerges is that they're the sovereigns. You know, the question about the Arctic Council as a soft law regime, you know, the rubber hits the road when you talk about national sovereignty. And in that context, I think that indigenous peoples, especially when we hear about the comprehensive land claims in Canada, the discussion of political independence in the Greenlandic context, the rights of Alaska Native corporations to actual land, surface, and subsurface, the efforts of the Sami to affirm and gain recognition of their rights to lands, territories, and resources, I would submit that indigenous peoples throughout the circumpolar region and elsewhere have absolutely a right in equity at the table with Arctic Rim nation states. We've heard all of the discussion about being the peoples that hold the risk and gain, or at least have suffer the potential adverse impacts in terms of the risk with regard to offshore oil and gas development. But I would further state that not only on the basis of the status and rights of indigenous peoples as peoples, the distinct status and rights of indigenous peoples within the Arctic, I would go even further and state that by virtue of these extraordinary political developments in the way of self-government and self-determination, that indigenous peoples have a responsibility to be at the table in the context of good governance, because like the North Slope Borough, like Greenland government, like the Sami Parliament, or like Nunavut, or the Nunatsiavut, all of the comprehensive land claims agreements that are inclusive of and embrace the right of self-government and self-determination, how is it that they are going to deliver good governance to their own people without safeguarding their status and rights and interests at every single table, whether it relates to security, whether it relates to economic development, whether it relates to issues concerning the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea? And just a quick reminder, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea doesn't deal with just delimitation issues. Those of you who are intimately familiar with it know it has numerous chapters concerning environmental protection, marine resource protection. Every single chapter references environmental protection. And if you think about how important this stock market is to the Inupiat and other Arctic indigenous peoples, then those provisions should not be forgotten in the context of larger issues related to jurisdiction and territory.
Daly, we're going to have to go to questions from the audience, but just very quickly, go from what you just said to the subject of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and tell us what significance that declaration has on all of the issues you just mentioned. Does it guarantee you any form of participation that you don't already have?
Well, I think that for those that do not know, what we're referencing is the outcome of a 25-year effort from 1982 until 2007 for the United Nations to uphold some of its basic obligations, and that is the promotion of human rights. People, especially nation-state government representatives, forget that that's one of their key obligations as member nations of the United Nations. The human rights regime within the United Nations did not have an indigenous-specific cultural context associated with it. And so the outcome in 2007 was the adoption by the General Assembly of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. I regard it as a very comprehensive international human rights instrument that touches upon, as has been discussed here and stated by Jimmy in particular, the right of self-determination, the right of self-government. It includes a range of operative paragraphs concerning the rights of indigenous peoples to lands, territories, and resources. Also, as I mentioned earlier, the right to determine our own priorities for our own development of our own lands, territories, and resources. What is significant about the instrument is that it also includes a range of customary international law principles like self-determination, like land rights, but also reparations and redress, which can be extraordinarily important for indigenous peoples. I think that the key thing to say about the UN Declaration and how it relates to this particular discussion about the Arctic is that it doesn't necessarily guarantee rights, because I think that we still have to have a major political and legal discussion with all parties concerned in order to gain recognition of and respect for the rights contained in the Declaration and how we operationalize those rights, how we redefine them between indigenous peoples and nation states. And I think in particular of what Jimmy has stated about the situation with the Russian Federation and the rights of indigenous peoples, the small nations of the Russian North. I mean, we in the United States, North America generally, Canada, elsewhere, have recourse mechanisms. We could, we've seen the outcome in terms of the comprehensive land claims agreements and so forth. So, no, the declaration doesn't necessarily guarantee those rights, but it establishes in a comprehensive international human rights instrument adopted by a majority of the member nations of the UN important guidelines and standards, minimum standards, to protect the rights of indigenous peoples. And I think that they can, in fact, be operationalized within the context of the Arctic Council and through increased discussion and dialogue. One final comment that I'll make is in relation to, again, President Grimson's comment about the Arctic Council as an inspirational model. In fact, I would suggest that the creation of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, which allows for 16 representatives, 8 nominated by indigenous organizations and 8 elected by nation states, serving in equity and reporting to the Economic and Social Council, is a reflection of utilizing the model of the Arctic Council in other contexts. And in this particular case, I think it's highly significant that the model of the Arctic Council has been mirrored or reflected elsewhere. But I should note that it is at a much higher level, and again, nation-state representatives and indigenous people seated in equity, reporting directly to the Economic and Social Council of the UN.
Thank you. Thank you. We could go on for many hours, and I know Jimmy has something to add. We are, I think, up against a hard stop. Charlie, am I right? And that means no time for audience questions. All I can say to you, Daly, in particular, is that I would really welcome the chance to have another public discussion just on this subject, because I think it's probably one of the least understood of the many, many new subjects in the Arctic. Jimmy, did you just want to add one thing? And then we're going to have to say goodbye.
Well, goodbye. I'd just like to bring it back home. The United States, as you know, accepted the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples with a 15-page memo of conditions to accepting it. And for those of you that haven't read it, it took one of the stronger points that was included in the declaration, which was the language indigenous peoples in their territories had the right to free, prior, and informed consent before activities occurred in their territories. Consent is a very strong word, as we know, particularly the lawyers out there. That became consultations, which means that the government must consult with indigenous peoples in the United States. The word consent is not in there. So.
To be continued. I can't thank you all enough. I think it's been a fascinating discussion.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd just stay in your seat just a few more minutes, I've asked Admiral Gary Roughead just to make some concluding remarks. Just very quickly, the Admiral is the Annenberg Distinguished Visiting Fellow at the Hoover Institution, having graduated from the Naval Academy in 1973. I'll just make one statement about the Admiral. He has some of the most distinguished medals awarded by the military service, and he is one of only 2 officers in the history in the history of the Navy to have commanded both the Atlantic and the Pacific fleets. Admiral.
Well, thank you, and Mr. President, Premier, all of the distinguished panelists today. It really is a pleasure for me to be here, to be the other coast's bookend of the project that Brookings has undertaken with the Hoover Institution as we continue our part to look at something that has long been of great importance to me, and that is what I have called the single greatest event since the end of the Ice Age that's taking place on our planet, and that's the opening of the Arctic. And what does it mean? As someone who has had the opportunity to be above, on, and under the Arctic, the perspective that I have long held is that it is an extraordinarily important place. It's a very special place that any initiatives must go forward with great care, and that's the reason why Hoover has engaged in the process with Brookings, and we are fortunate at Hoover to have the leadership of former Secretary of State George Shultz. He's also former Secretary of the Treasury, so to say he has a little bit of experience in policy making is an understatement. But he, too, is captured by the importance of what is taking place in the Arctic. Our approach and what we will continue to do with our initiative is to examine, particularly from the U.S. side, what we should be doing, thinking about, and indeed investing in. It's often talked about how quickly the ice is going away, but I will tell you as a practitioner, the Arctic is still going to be a very challenging place from the standpoint of the environment. And we talk about transportation, we talk about resources, but there is still much that needs to be done. When you consider the fact that only about 10% of the bottom of the Arctic Ocean has been surveyed. That is a serious shortcoming when you talk about safety, security, response. As was mentioned by one of the participants here, the ability to sense what is moving in the Arctic and how you respond to events in the Arctic is going to be extraordinarily important. When we look at the need to deal with the ice, and as even though we talk about the Arctic being ice-free, my sense is that at least for the next couple of decades, ice, like politics, will be local. And how do you deal with that localized challenge as ships become icebound or ports become icebound? And then what do we as the United States need to do to develop the capabilities to operate in those environments? And I've long believed that we have been late to need on things such as domain awareness, the ability to respond in the case of search and rescue and in environmental conditions. So what are some of the new ways that we can think about providing for that, whether it's public-private partnerships, new ways of recapitalizing ice-breaking fleets, all done cooperatively with the other Arctic nations. So that's where we're going. We're pleased to be able to be part of that with Brookings, and I look forward to a continued discussion on this very, very important matter. So thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank all our panelists of the day, and particularly our last panelists, as I haven't gotten to thank you personally. And thank the audience for your very good questions, and we're delighted you could all join us today and look forward to you at future events. And I particularly want to thank President Grimson and Prime Minister Kleist for having traveled so far to join us. Thank you very much. Thank you all.